First, we open Google Earth, find the U.S., and we're heading right here to California. We start walking and keep going all the way to that blue car over there. Stop. I've just walked about this much compared to the full size of the biggest ant colony in the United States. Yep, right here under the road where I'm standing, millions of ants are running around inside their base. Now I'm going to zoom out so you can see the colony's full size on the map. Here it is, from San Diego to San Francisco. Before the 20th century, there were exactly zero Argentine ants in the US, and now there are billions. And the largest super colony stretches more than 500 miles, and that's only the American version. In Europe, the colony is even bigger, about 3,700 miles from northern Italy across southern France all the way to Spain's Atlantic coast. These little jerks took over everything from scratch in just 100 years. Why little jerks? Take a look at their cousins, fire ants. In this video, they literally start a house fire because they chewed through the wiring. They also kill cows on farms. Here's a photo of them eating the cow's eyes. Ants have started doing a whole bunch of other horrific stuff too. I think the point is pretty obvious by now. Of course, people have tried poisoning ants in 1,000 different ways. And yeah, it didn't work. And then this guy comes up with an idea for stopping the apocalypse that's coming. Let's take a look at one specific ant. This ant looks just like the others, but it starts acting weird. It doesn't leave the nest, doesn't forage, doesn't help the colony. It doesn't do anything at all. And that's because its body isn't really its own anymore. A parasite inside is eating it from the inside out. Weeks pass, and the ant finally does leave the nest, but only to wander far away from its own kind. Then at some point, its head falls off, and out of it crawls a fly. It's tiny, only about 1/10 of an inch long, barely a speck compared to the ant, and yet it's one of the most terrifying enemies an ant colony can face. And at that moment, the man realizes there's a way to wipe out these gigantic anthills along with every last one of their inhabitants. It's a tiny fly. It's about the size of an ant's head, roughly 0.04 to 0.08 inches long. In the wild, it looks like a little fuzzy speck hovering above the ants. Hold on, is that their personal killer drone? Well, not exactly. Parasitoids are parasites with a twisted logic. They don't just live off a host, they kill it. Not by accident, not as a sometimes it happens side effect, but as the whole point. Their life cycle is designed so the host dies in the end every time. And in this story, the hosts are fire ants. Now picture the worst possible scene for an ant. Hanging over the trail is a tiny fly, hovering like it's scanning the crowd. It doesn't strike at random, it's searching for the right individual. What is this, an audition? Yeah. And the moment it picks its target, the attack begins. The fly darts forward, closes the distance, injects an egg straight into the ant's body, and vanishes. It happens so fast you can barely see it. The whole strike takes a fraction of a second, and afterward, the ant basically drops out of life for a moment. It stumbles, tries to get its bearings, and still manages to run back to the colony. Only now, it's no longer just an ant, it's carrying a parasite. How does the fly do that physically? The female has a hardened ovipositor, a tool it uses to drive the egg inside. One strike, one egg. And over its lifetime, a single female can lay anywhere from 100 to 300 eggs, essentially infecting hundreds of ants, and then killing them. A few days later, the larva hatches and begins its migration. Not just anywhere, straight into the head capsule of a worker ant. And here's the question, when does the ant realize something's wrong? Almost never. There are three developmental stages, and throughout all of them, it behaves normally, as if nothing is happening. Then pupation begins, and at that moment, tissues inside the ant's head start disappearing. They're literally eaten from the inside. The outcome's always the same. The ant dies, the head often falls off, the mouth parts spread apart, and the pupa becomes visible right in the mouth. And that's the spot where the adult fly eventually emerges. This isn't a quick process. The larva develops for about 2 to 3 weeks. Then the pupal stage takes another 2 to 3 weeks, depending on temperature and species. Great, now I'm gonna start checking every suspiciously silent ant. And here's the crucial twist. The infected ant returns to the nest, but it no longer forages or works the way it used to. It's as if it drops out of the colony's normal life. The change isn't sudden. It feels like someone quietly took away its will. Now it's a zombie, doing only what the parasite inside, the master, needs. Because the larva is growing. By the third stage, it's much larger, and it needs room, food, and space. What's inside the head is the next step, and the brain, of course, is saved for last, so the ant keeps moving right up to the end. But emerging inside the nest would be stupid, far too dangerous. Can you imagine what it's like to end up inside a giant fire ant mound when nobody there's expecting you? That's why the zombie ant leaves. A few hours before the finale, it walks out of the colony alone. Then it finds a suitable spot, stops, and then, most likely, enzymes are released that soften the connective tissue. The head falls off. That's basically where the name comes from, decapitating flies. After that, the larva finishes developing inside the severed head capsule. A couple of weeks later, an adult fly emerges, and it doesn't live long. It mates, goes searching for new ant hosts, and the cycle starts again. So we've got flies that kill fire ants, and that sounds like great news because fire ants aren't just annoying insects. They're voracious predators, and they're very good at making human life miserable, too. First of all, fire ants are major agricultural pests. They damage soybeans, potatoes, corn seedlings, and even young citrus trees. And the warmer the climate, the more comfortably they thrive. But crop losses are one thing. Their stings are a real health hazard, especially for small children and for people who are allergic to their toxins. It can even be fatal. Then it gets downright bizarre. Fire ants invade machinery. They damage electrical equipment, transformers, air conditioner compressors. There have even been cases where they knocked out runway lights at airfields. Ants that can cause an air disaster? Doesn't it feel like nature is holding a grudge? And all of this is done by a creature you can barely see, a tiny wrecking machine. Fire ants have spread across the world, colonizing countries, disrupting ecosystems, and the damage is measured in billions of dollars. They're now officially considered one of the most dangerous invasive species on the planet, and one of the most expensive to fight. The U.S. first took notice of them in the 1930s, and ever since they've become part of everyday life there, so much so that fire ant stings have been linked to the deaths of more than 80 people. That may not sound like a lot, but beyond fatal stings, fire ants cost the United States over $6 billion every year in damages. Australia, for example, set aside $400 million for just 4 years of an eradication program, and that, believe it or not, is described as a small part. Because if the ants keep spreading, the price tag would be far worse. And here's the most unsettling part. A few years ago, fire ants finally reached Europe. Researchers believe their range could push farther north over the coming decades, meaning the global threat is only going to grow. Against that backdrop, the fly suddenly stops looking like a nightmare. If anything, people start to see it as a potential way out. If there's a creature that naturally kills fire ants, why not try putting it to work? So in the early 2000s, several species of decapitating Pseudactian flies were introduced to North America. The goal was simple and uncompromising, to rein in the invasive red imported fire ant, Solenopsis invicta. Not to wipe it out overnight, but at least to knock down its numbers and ease the pressure on ecosystems. That's biological control. The enemy of your enemy is your friend. So if we have a common enemy, we can work together. Bad news, the fly can't just wipe out an entire ant colony. In Florida, they even ran a long-term field experiment, and it found no measurable impact from the flies on the population of the introduced fire ants. So we brought them a killer and they didn't even notice? Pretty much. The released decapitating flies turned out not to be very effective, and the numbers show it. In a single colony, the share of infected ants rarely climbs above 3-4%, and it's usually under 1%. That level of mortality barely puts a dent in colony growth. The mound just keeps going as if nothing special happened. But that actually makes sense. It's not in the fly's interest to kill off the whole colony. If the ants disappear, the flies have no host to parasitize. Their entire life cycle is tied to ants. They can't really exist without them. So if the flies truly were mowing fire ants down to the last one, that would be bizarre, self-destructive behavior. Evolution favors something else, infecting a small fraction of workers, just enough that generations of flies can live off the same mound for years. But here's the good news. The real value of these flies isn't that they massacre the colony, it's that they make the colony weaker. That's what people decided to bet on. Not direct extermination, but constant pressure. So not kill them, just wear them down. Yeah, pretty much. The larvae parasitize fire ant workers and eventually kill them. That's already bad news for the colony because the workers are the anthill's hands, feet, and supply chain. Lose a few workers and everything that keeps the colony afloat starts to suffer. Foraging, construction, expansion. But the adults are even more interesting. They don't even have to infect anyone to do damage. It's enough to hover over the ants while searching for a target. And the ants start to panic. Workers may freeze or curl into an upside-down C, supposedly making it harder for the fly to land an egg. The result is that the presence of a single fly can stop or seriously slow down food gathering for hundreds of workers. And once fire ants stop feeding the colony properly and guarding their territory, native ant species re-enter the picture. They seize the moment and reclaim patches they'd lost before. Back in the late 1970s, a University of Texas graduate student named Don Feener put it neatly, "The fly's main weapon isn't mortality, it's stress and activity paralysis." Of course, fire ants aren't stupid. They've developed a whole toolkit of defensive strategies and actively keep an eye on the flies. Still, it's a weird situation. The fly is tiny, the damage is pinpoint, but the effect is mass scale. Even in Florida, after all the field trials, researchers came to the same conclusion. Releasing additional species of decapitating flies could improve the results. In other words, the strategy is still about sustained pressure. So why wait for the flies to maybe settle in on their own when you could run a real program instead? Do it the way they do with screwworm flies or mosquitoes. Breed them in huge numbers and keep releasing them into the wild to keep the pest under control. So we're officially moving into industrial fly dispersal. Honestly, I pictured the 21st century differently. And this isn't science fiction. Imagine hundreds of millions of flies being dropped from airplanes. It sounds like a nightmare, but for farmers, it's protection. That's exactly how officials are trying to stop New World screwworms, which lay eggs in the wounds of warm-blooded animals, and the larvae then eat the host alive. Since early 2023, the outbreak has been moving through Central America, Panama, Costa Rica, Nicaragua, Honduras, places that hadn't seen them in nearly 20 years. In November, the fly reached southern Mexico, and alarms went off in the U.S. immediately. But this has happened before, and back in the 1960s and 1970s, the U.S. nearly wiped them out. They used a method that sounded bizarre, but worked. They bred sterilized males and released them from airplanes in huge numbers. Females mated, the eggs produced no offspring, and the population started collapsing. Now a facility in Panama is doing the same thing again, raising sterilized screwworms, loading them onto planes, and dispersing them over the narrowest strip of land between South and North America. It creates a living insect barrier. There's another proven approach, too. A company breeds genetically modified male insects and releases them into the wild. Any offspring from those matings don't survive to adulthood. And since females of many species mate only once in their lifetime, the method turns out to be surprisingly effective. This has already been done with mosquitoes and the pink bollworm. Genetically modified males were released in Brazil, Malaysia, Panama, and several U.S. states. Not just in labs, but out in the real world, in places where the problem had already spiraled out of control. The clearest example is Grand Cayman. Starting in 2009, about 3.3 million transgenic males were released there. The result was tangible. The population of Aedes aegypti mosquitoes dropped by roughly 80%. Fewer mosquitoes means fewer bites, and more importantly, less spread of deadly diseases, so the idea of mass insect releases as a control tool has been around for a long time, and is already widely used. All of that sounds great, but what about the flies? In some places, they were released specifically as a biological control for fire ants. And they didn't just survive, they established themselves. In the U.S. and Puerto Rico, six species of pseudoactian flies have become firmly established. Some of them have spread across much of the country. Estimates suggest P. tricuspis now occurs across at least 65% of the range occupied by invasive fire ants, and P. curvatus also covers nearly 100% of that range in the U.S. In other words, these flies aren't confined to a single nursery site. They're genuinely expanding right alongside their hosts. Other species have also taken over huge areas. For example, Pseudoactian obtusus is found across large parts of Florida and Texas and has likely already moved into neighboring states. Three more species have established only locally, limited to certain areas of Alabama, Texas, and Florida. So, the obvious question is, where did they even get the flies if the U.S. didn't have them? The program began in 1997, and the flies were literally imported from the fire ants' native range. Two biotypes were brought to the U.S. One was collected near Las Flores in Buenos Aires province, Argentina, right off the S. richteri species. The second biotype, P. curvatus, was found on red fire ants about 22 miles northwest of Formosa, also in Argentina. At the same time, researchers were collecting flies in Brazil as well. The first releases took place in Florida in 1997 and 2000. Florida was the perfect launch pad, mild climate, huge fire ant populations, and perfect conditions to test the concept. It quickly became clear, though, running everything through a single lab would be painfully slow. That's when the next goal emerged, mass rearing. Starting in spring 2001, FDAX's division of plant industry began large-scale production of one fly species, the one considered the most promising among nearly 20 species that parasitize fire ants. From there, the process was straightforward. The raised flies were shipped to field sites and released across the southern states, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, and beyond. To put the scale in perspective, the ARS lab in Gainesville initially produced about 1,500 flies per day. And that was enough for only 2 to 3 sites per month. That's why the larger DPI facilities that came online in 2001 were expected to double output, with plans to ramp up releases even further after that. These days, they don't breed these flies wherever they can anymore. They raise them at a dedicated facility in Florida. Everything there is designed to make adult flies perfectly comfortable parasitizing fire ants. Not a lab, more like an ant hell with climate control. The main stage is a set of large containers they literally call attack boxes. Inside, ants live in special trays. But how do you keep the ants constantly out in the open so the flies don't have to dig them out of hiding spots? The answer is clever and unsettling. Each tray has a pair of small lifting cups that take turns moving up and down. The ants are forced to crawl back and forth nonstop, trying to take shelter under a cup, then losing it and running again. They even try to stash their brood under those cups so that movement never stops for a second. They simply have nowhere to hide properly. If brood is brought in from another colony, they don't dump it straight in with the workers. They give them at least half an hour to blend in so the colony doesn't erupt into an internal brawl. Then the cycle starts again, and the cups keep moving from morning till evening. At night, everything stops, so both the insects and the people supervising them can rest. The ants are fed surprisingly well. Test tubes of sugar solution provide a constant energy source, plus crickets for protein. Meanwhile, as the ants scramble around the trays, the flies can hover overhead, attack, and lay eggs. No stalking, no waiting for the right moment. The ants are kept exposed the whole time. They don't stand a chance. It's like running on a conveyor belt with monsters overhead. The flies themselves enter the attack box from a separate emergent container. Then the sorting begins. Infected ants are picked out by weight because a larva is already developing inside, and that changes their mass. Those ants are moved into separate trays. There, they quietly live out the rest of their lives while the next generation of flies develops inside their heads and bodies. Okay, but how do you release them so the flies actually start suppressing the ants? You can't just open a box and say, "All right, off you go." The fly has to end up exactly where the ants are active. Ideally, during a panic when workers are running around on the surface instead of hiding. To see whether it worked, at each site, they disturbed about 10 ant mounds and then watched closely for half an hour to see if the flies were hovering over the ants. It did work. Overwinterizing fly populations successfully established at 6 of the 8 release sites. Then the geography comes into play. Over the next few years, fly numbers climb to levels comparable to or even higher than their native populations in South America. By fall 1999, they had spread about 0.6 to 3.7 miles from the release points and covered roughly 48 square miles. A year later, the picture looked completely different. By fall 2000, several hotspots had merged into one large zone about 43 miles across, around 1,274 square miles. Another year on, the flies pushed 6 to 19 miles farther and occupied about 3,127 square miles. Okay, they really did take off. Sometimes they used an even cleverer tactic. They'd take worker ants to the lab, let the flies do their thing, then return those ants to their nests as carriers that seeded the infestation. Sometimes they combined both methods. But there's one obvious concern. What if these flies become invasive themselves? We bring them in, release them, help them reproduce. What if we end up with a whole new set of consequences? Saved one thing, killed another scenario, huh? A classic. The Pseudactyon species that parasitize fire ants originally came from the same places as their hosts. Their natural home is the tropical and subtropical regions of South America, where they stay active year-round. And the flies that were introduced into the U.S. were taken specifically from Brazil and Argentina. Now, it's important to understand what invasive actually means. The term usually refers to a newcomer species that becomes a problem, stealing resources from native species, disrupting ecosystems, or overwhelming others through sheer numbers. But with these flies, the whole idea is the exact opposite. They weren't brought over randomly. They were introduced to parasitize another invasive species, the fire ant. So they're stepping into a problem that already exists and helping solve it. Hold on, what if they switched to local ants and wiped them out? Nope, because these flies are basically fanatics. In the United States, released decapitating flies of the genus Pseudactyon target only fire ants of the genus Solenopsis. Studies conducted before and after their release confirm the same thing. The flies show no interest in other ants, other arthropods, or any other animals, humans included. They don't swarm food, fruit, garbage, carrion, feces, or anything like that. They don't damage crops, and they don't harm decorative or native plants. Their specialization is so narrow that, in practice, the only creatures they can actually wipe out are those ants. And even that would be in the very distant future, on an evolutionary timescale of thousands to millions of years. Can you actually wipe out fire ants completely? In theory, yes. In practice, it's hard, expensive, and not always possible everywhere. There's one rare example people love to cite as proof it can be done. New Zealand's the only country that has successfully eradicated the red imported fire ant. They recorded just 3 incursions, at Auckland International Airport in 2001, at Napier Port in 2004, and at Wiranaki in a forestry area in 2006. By 2009, the species was officially declared eradicated. Many experts like this story because it shows how crucial early detection and monitoring are, but New Zealand had a head start. Most countries don't. Strict biosecurity rules were already in place. The country had a track record of national pest control programs, and the public generally understood what invasive species are. And there's another factor you can't ignore. It's an island, a relatively small area, actually manageable to monitor and control. If we compare that with the United States, a vast territory, and the ants are already widely established, the odds of total eradication drop sharply. Europe's still in the middle stage. In Italy, for instance, the ants may have been present for years before they were discovered, and eradication measures only began 2 years after official confirmation. By then, precious time had already been lost. First it's, oh, come on, it's only an ant, and then it's, where did all our millions go? Still, Europe has a chance, because the infestation isn't anywhere near US scale yet, so maybe this is the exact moment to bring the flies over there. You owe me a like. See you later.